It's time for Money for Lunch, where we feed your brain and your business with supersized portions of business and financial news. Now your host, Bert Martinez.
All right. Welcome back to Money for Lunch. Good to have you here. Always appreciate our loyal listeners, and so I thank you for that. And anyone who's going to be in the Scottsdale, Arizona area, we're going to be doing a little get-together with comedian Tom Arnold this weekend. So if you want to connect with us, possibly have a photo shoot with Tom Arnold, and just have some fun at the Laugh Factory in Scottsdale, shoot me an email is what I meant, or hit me up on Facebook or Twitter, Bert@BertMartinez.com, or you can find me on all social medias under the name Bert Martinez. And we'll take care of you, give you some tickets, and like I said, possibly a photo shoot as well with yours truly and Tom Arnold. And if you're not in the Scottsdale area, well, hopefully you'll have some fun this weekend anyway, right? Also, snippets of information. I say snippets because really I got somebody asking me on Facebook, and then I got a direct email. So regarding our real estate course that we have started, it is just unbelievably fun. It's a great way for somebody to make money part-time or full-time working from home. It's a real live training. It's a real training program. It helps you make money in the real estate market. And the best part is we're teaching people how to do it with no money or credit. So if that is of interest to you, definitely, again, find me on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or just send me an email, Bert@BertMartinez.com, and I'll connect you for the information there. And this is great, especially if you're a stay-at-home mom or if you already have a job and you're looking to maybe supplement that income, or you've always been interested in real estate, kind of like that's the thing that attracted me. I've always been interested in real estate, and I've done a lot of real estate deals over the years. So, but I started cautiously, and I show everybody how I started and how easy it is. But it's like anything else. Once you know how to do it, you just can't believe how easy it is. But it does take time, does take a little effort. All right, speaking of you and your money, my first guest, Wesley Wood. Wesley Wood is CEO and president of Wood Financial Group. Yes, Wood Financial Group, and Advisors Academy board member. Wesley Wood is the founder and president, of the Wood Financial Group. Sorry about that. My teleprompter all of a sudden started blinking, and I'm trying to adjust it and talk at the same time, so it's not working out very well. The company is located in Hendersonville, Tennessee. He's a graduate of the University of Mississippi. Wesley received a bachelor's degree in business administration. He holds several licenses and is licensed in multiple states. Wesley Wood, welcome to Money for Lunch.
Hey, thanks, Bert, for having me on. And I love your show, and I even like the title. That's clever. It doesn't, you know, Money for Lunch does not sound very appetizing. But I'm a big believer in time management, making the best use of your time during work hours. And so, hey, if you can make a few extra bucks by listening to your show during the lunch hour, I think that's a great way to go about doing it.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, you know, you get a bunch of entrepreneurs together for lunch, and, mm-hmm. you know, what do we start talking about? Well, sooner or later we talk about business, or
right.
really we start talking about money, how to make it, how to keep it, how to make it work for you. So that's kind of where the title came from. But we appreciate your support, and let's talk about this. I want to dive into this. How big of a problem is student loans now in our country?
It's a huge issue. I mean, you're looking at over a third of the students graduating these days from college having an average of $30,000 in student loans. And so, you know, what does that really mean? You know, if you look at that, I mean, the heavy burden that somebody has as soon as they graduate, now they've got to worry about, you know, what do they do next? What's their next steps? Where should they? Should they pay off this thing? Should they save for retirement? Should they try to buy a house? So it's a big deal. And, you know, good, bad, or indifferent, I know it's been there's a light being shined on it through the political environment. And hopefully
right.
there's going to be some changes, whether it's positive or negative. But it needs to be something that people are aware of, that if they take on this burden, what's their next steps as far as when they graduate, what to do next?
Well, you know what, and what's interesting to me, when I was growing up, getting a student loan was just, you know, part of the deal, right? I mean, if your family wasn't in the financial position to pay for your, your college, you took out a student loan, or some people did a combination of student loan and they worked through school or worked through summer, things of that nature, and just made it happen. But what is upsetting so many people is the fact that these student loans have grown so quickly. I think that there is an article I read where I think the cost of a student loan is up like 1,200% in just a decade or something like that.
And
that's really what people are so outraged about, is that the student loan, first of all, it's supposed to be this government-backed situation, but it's gotten so expensive that, as you said, it's become a burden, and people are literally, you know, taking 20, 30, 40 years to pay off their student loan. I mean, I don't know. Do you know what the average number is to pay one of these student loans off are now?
No, you got it. It's about 25 to 30 years. So if you got somebody graduating college, let's just say in their mid-20s, just to keep the numbers simple, you're looking at, gosh, it could be almost 50 years old by the time this thing is finally paid off. And if you think about just interest rates, I mean, some of these student loans, the rates can be pretty high. Let's just say to put dollars to this, if you say the average rate on a student loan is 6%, I mean, that if they don't make appropriate payments and not pay on it for a little while, this thing could double. So if you got a $30,000 student loan, if you don't really pay on it, it could be at $60,000 literally in 12 to 15 years. So it just continues steamrolling the cost of this thing, and it just continues to blow up like a bubble.
Yeah, no, that's amazing. And what happens nowadays if you don't pay your student loans?
Well, you know, it depends. I mean, a student loan is it's not something that you can just not pay and go bankrupt,
right,
and wrap it up and it's gone. That's common, where people think, well, you know, if I just can't pay this thing, I'm just not going to worry about it. It's not a credit card. It's not a mortgage. It's not a car note. They're not just going to come take your car. It's something that does not go away. So it's very important that people focus on actually paying this student loan off and not just kicking that can down the road.
Yeah, and if I'm not mistaken, and I'm glad you pointed this out, first of all, that this is, because it has this government component to it, it doesn't go away. You can't file bankruptcy and make it go away. It doesn't matter what the situation is. Unless you're dead, this debt will never go away.
Exactly. That's why we try to advise people to really get a clear understanding of how much their student loan is, what's the interest rate, and then start identifying what's the best way. Should we be paying this thing off, or should we look at paying for retirement? Or, you know, we really try to give people advice if they have a student loan, what's their next steps?
Sure. All right, so let's talk about this real quick. What is the best way to pay off these student loans?
Yeah, you know, I kind of review with people in that, I think, five different ways to really not only pay off their student loan but save money for retirement, because there's a study a while back that said if someone had $30,000 in student loans, which is roughly the average amount for a college senior graduating nowadays, it could cost them about $325,000 in lost retirement savings, compared to somebody that graduated college debt-free. This is according to the LIMRA Secure Retirement Institute. So you're talking about a $325,000 maybe cut to having all that extra money there waiting for them when they do retire, depending on where their money flows for retirement. So what I always like to look at is, you know, when talking with somebody, if they have a student loan, you don't necessarily need to just turn around and not buy that first house or not do certain things, but you need to be at least the first step is know, have a clear understanding of how much you owe and have a clear understanding of what is the interest rate. And if you have several of them, which is the highest interest rate? Because you're going to want to pay off the ones that have more of a higher interest rate than the ones that have a lower one, obviously, because those higher interest rates ones are going to you know, build up quicker. The next step is, you know, we do suggest for a lot of folks to continue to save for retirement because there's a lot of great avenues that you can save for retirement. Actually, kind of use your student loan. I don't want to call it as put it into your investment plan, but know that it's there. But instead of just paying it all off at once, if you have, like, for instance, a 401k at work, and they're going to give you what we call free money in a 401k, where you can put money into a 401k. They're going to match you at that 401k. That's tough to beat, and you're probably going to get somewhat of a tax break because it comes off of your adjusted gross income. So you want to know your other accounts, the other things that you've got going on financially. So if you do have one of those 401k accounts, you don't want to give up that free money because it may leverage itself against that that student loan to where you could build up wealth quicker. Also, probably the biggest step that we suggest for people is don't delay. You definitely want to get the ball rolling and start early, reviewing your plan, reviewing your student loan, and then creating a clear process on how to get that thing knocked out and also save for retirement.
Yes, and I want to focus here for a few minutes. This is a mistake that I have made, and I think a lot of people make, and you know, we get these mixed signals about the benefits of being debt-free. And first of all, debt isn't always bad.
Right.
And second of all, the student loans, even though they do have a lot of hooks in them, they're fairly low interest rate loans.
Correct.
As opposed to, let's say, a credit card that typically are not. This false sense of urgency to pay off the student loan pales in comparison to the reality of retirement is more important. If you were to take, let's say, $50,000 and you pay off your student loan, that's great. However, you take that same $50,000 and it could be worth, you know, $100,000, if not more, in 10 years.
Yep.
You know, and so, and meanwhile, during those 10 years, you're chipping away at your student loan, and there's just so much more peace and tranquility and security knowing that you have $50,000 or $100,000 or $200,000 of in your savings in your retirement account versus, you know, being debt-free.
Right, exactly. And we see a lot of folks that kind of come in and you know, most of our clients are in their retirement, so student loans coming through our door, there's not that many, but we'll have people ask about their grandchildren or their children. They'll say, oh, my gosh, my child has this big student loan, and what do they need to do? And unfortunately, kind of the gut reaction for a lot of folks is, I just got to pay this thing off immediately. So they'll end up sabotaging maybe their emergency savings or what they need to have sitting at the bank to pay for those 3 to 6 months of emergencies that could come up, like a new car, a new roof, or a new air conditioner unit. So you don't want to sabotage what you've got currently in place just to try to get, like you said, debt-free, because there is kind of a misconception. I agree that being debt-free in retirement is great. It's a fantastic kind of peace of mind, but
yes,
you definitely don't want to, you know, end up upsetting or disturbing your future goals.
Absolutely. And you know, you said something that I want to emphasize, and that is being debt free in retirement. So yes, being debt free in retirement is, I think, the ideal situation. But you know, again, if you're 20 or 30 or even 40 years old,
yep,
I think your priority should be for yourself, saving money versus paying off the student loan. And the other reason for my thinking like this is that you mentioned at the beginning of the segment that, you know, this is constantly something that politicians are batting around. So you never know what's going to happen. You know, there is a proposal to make student loans. I don't know the financial wording for this, but there's a proposal to have I think the right now the way the student loan works is you make a payment like all loans, and it goes to pay off the interest first, then the principal. Well, they're thinking about reversing that, so that way you're able to pay it off quicker, faster, and thereby saving tons of money on interest. Because the reality is, the most important thing is for the government to get that money back so they can lend it out again, and help, you know, and help more people become educated and self-sustaining, and that's really going to be more beneficial than having our government make tons of interest on it. So my point being is, you never know. Today's student loan may be completely different 5 years from today.
Sure. And, you know, it's hard to predict the future. Nobody's got a crystal ball. But
right.
I do believe, like you, that they're moving towards making these things easier, making them to where the people have a better understanding, which is a good thing. I don't necessarily agree with everything that the government does, but it is definitely a good thing. I think people do need help to an extent as far as this idea of just forgiving student loans. I can't imagine that happening, but I do think that it'll be a way to kind of get that money back into the system. And I know you talk to a lot of folks, your listeners, a lot of folks that are entrepreneurs and business people, and you know, a lot of folks have so much confidence in their business that they know that they can turn a dollar into three. And so to take, you know, to just turn around and take money maybe out of their business to pay off a student loan may not be the best idea. Maybe it'd be better than just to continue investing that money in the business. And if people start kind of thinking more like that for folks that are able to turn profits and make money, a lot of people will even just leverage their student loan. I mean, that's not something that we recommend very often, but maybe just pay a little bit more in the interest, pay it off over time, but know that, hey, if you've got that capital reserve sitting in your business and you're able to turn some of those dollars into more dollars, just investing it right back into you and building wealth over time, eventually one day maybe you'll be able to just write a check and pay that whole thing off and just get it off your balance sheet.
Right. And that, I think, is the way to go. For everybody listening, that should be your strategy. Forget how much debt you have, because it really doesn't matter. Look, if you have $1 million worth of debt, yes, that's a lot of money. But the question is, what are you doing with it? So so a student loan that might be $40,000 or $50,000 or $100,000 is, on its face, a lot of money or a lot of debt. But what are you doing with it? Now, if you spend $100,000 on student loans and you have a liberal arts degree, you better figure out what you're going to do with it. Maybe you need to go back and get a law degree or something with it. But, you know, bottom line is, it is about the leverage. And speaking of leverage, we're going to take a quick commercial break, and then we'll be back with Wesley Wood talking about you and your money, some of your financial debt, and the student loans right after this.
Did you bring the camera phone?
I did.
Do you want to go first?
I've been waiting for this all day.
Okay, this is Fro and Stacy.
Introducing Chase Quick Deposit. Just photograph the front and back of your check using the Chase mobile app on your iPhone and hit send.
It went through?
So cool.
This is so cool.
You want to try it?
Yeah.
Okay.
All right, it was nice.
Make a deposit from anywhere, anytime with your iPhone.
To Mr. and Mrs. Walker, why would they send my parents a check?
Chase what matters.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch. And check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.
We are back. My first guest today, Wesley Wood, CEO and President of Wood Financial Group. And we're talking about what to do with your student loan. And if you're just joining us, bottom line, what you should be doing with your is, yes, pay off your student loan, but not sacrifice the important things like retirement. Retirement first, student loan debt second. And you know what? I want to talk about this, Wesley, because I think this is something that's very difficult. I know this is one of the challenges I have. When I was in my 20s, even early 30s, the thought of retirement seemed like such a long time away in the future that it seemed silly, almost a waste of my capital to start saving for retirement. And of course, when you hit 40, you start thinking retirement. Oh man, I should have done it sooner, sooner than this. And especially now that I'm in my 50s, we just had this, back in 2007, 2008, a lot of us took hits, and so retirement becomes takes on a different. Focus in your life. But what do you say to a 20-year-old or somebody who's thinking retirement is just not the right time right now?
Well, it's interesting you say that. I think financially somebody really needs to understand what's the point of their money, what are they wanting their money to do for them. And if
right.
one day they do want to retire, they got to starting early is just so important. It makes such a big difference because the good old days of where I see a lot of older clients now, they have pensions and they've got these profit sharing plans and they've got where they've got this guaranteed stream of income coming from a pension company for their
mm-hmm,
previous
mm-hmm.
company that they worked with for so many years. And they just said, hey, I know I've got that in the background, so I'm not going to really worry with it as much. Nowadays, however, folks do not have, there's really hardly any companies I'm aware of that have pensions out there that can just give you a steady stream of income for life. You got
right.
Social Security, yes, which a lot of people are concerned about that. But even if you say, okay, Social Security is going to be there for retirement, and you look at the dollars, for most folks, that's only about a third of their income. So I always talk to people that are in their 20s and 30s is that, okay, if you had to be unemployed for 30 years, how would you survive? Which basically that's what I think of retirement. It's an unemployment for 30 years, 65 to 95 or even further. So I think it kind of gets people thinking like, oh, that would be very, very tough to live off of maybe a third of the income that I have coming in. So if you start earlier, the power of compounding interest, the power of deferring taxes in retirement programs, and the power of just saving in general is amazing. I read a study a while back that said, the difference between somebody saving the same amount of dollars every month, meaning that somebody puts away, I can't remember the exact numbers, but let's just say $500 a month that starts at 25 versus somebody that starts $500 a month at 35, but both retire at the age of 65, the person who started that 10 years earlier would have twice as much money for retirement.
Yes, yes.
It's astounding how much difference it is if you can just kind of get that ball rolling as quick as possible.
Absolutely. You know what? I love the fact that Einstein was quoted multiple times talking about the effects of compound interest and the fact that it was the most brilliant thing that anybody had ever come out with, and that even he didn't totally understand how powerful it was or how it truly worked. But yes, to add to what you said there, yes, there's a similar story where, two brothers, they're twin brothers, and one started, one started saving from the age of 25 until he was 45, and then he stopped adding to his retirement, and the other brother started at the age of 45 until he was 65, and same thing, the brother who started first had two or three times the amount of money because of the compound effect. And so we just, when I say we as a society do not make it a priority to save money anymore. We don't teach our children the importance of saving anymore. It's very uncommon to see a family with one income.
Yeah.
Now you got everybody working and nobody saving.
Right. Right.
And so, I think the statistics are is that the average family can only be out of work for like 30 days before they have to start considering getting some financial help or bankruptcy. And that the average family cannot afford a $700 emergency. Bottom line is, look, money is the most important thing of this world. Meaning, it's not more important than spiritual, it's not more important than health, and it's not more important than love. But when it comes to worldly matters, money is the most important thing. And you cannot pay your hospital bill with a great relationship, and you cannot, you know, pay for, you know, again, as we started our conversation today, you cannot pay for your college fund, you know, with a healthy body. You need money. You need money for everything in this planet. And I just, you know, again, just because, you know, what do you call it? I'm older now. You know, you start to realize that, man, one of the things I would have done sooner is I would have started saving. I would have, you know, started looking at my savings really as that fortress of solitude. You know, my father-in-law, you mentioned pension. So my father-in-law is a great example to me because he's that kind of guy who worked for a bank for 30 plus years, retired with a pension. Now, he's also, because of his banking training, he did a lot of conservative investing here and there, and he probably could have done something a little bit better. But the thing that a lot of us don't think about, and this is what happened to my father-in-law, is that his bank, after being around over 120 years, after he had left the bank 5 or 6 years after he had left the bank, somebody had committed some financial fraud within the bank, and that bank went out of business. So his pension was gone.
Golly.
So, but luckily he had a bunch of money in savings. He had a bunch of money in some other kind of retirement. And then he did get Social Security benefits. But most of us could not sustain that kind of blow. Back to your saying, most people rely on their pension. But what if your pension, for whatever reason, disappeared? And you know, bottom line is we have to kind of think that way. We have to be thinking off, you know, what do you call it, offensively, because by the time we start, you know, if we get into that defensive mode, it's usually too late.
Right, right. Yeah, you definitely want to be more proactive than reactive. And just to kind of go along with, and I couldn't have said everything you said better than you just did, but, you know, I've heard the saying before, and I kind of chuckled and said, you know, money doesn't buy happiness, but it definitely puts a nice down payment on it.
Yes.
And, you know, I'll tell you that the folks that do get to retirement, they've got enough money saved up and they realize it, they're just more comfortable, just that peace of mind that folks have. And, you know, it's amazing to me that half of the divorces out there are caused by financial woes and financial problems, because I really think it comes down to a lot of those, and I don't have the more numbers than just that, but I bet that a lot of folks just live like paycheck to paycheck, beyond their means, and really just don't think about the future. And if they just simply said, you know what, if I get $1,000 a month of income, I need to put a little bit of this away. But instead they get $1,000 a month of income, and they spend every dime of it, and they get accustomed to just spending every single dollar that comes in. And then something like happens, they don't have any money, then they have to do a whole bunch of stressful things like selling things. It creates dynamics and family relationships that really don't need to be there. So people just kind of get a little bit more cognizant of how important it is to just make sure that their financial house is strong. I think you'd see those statistics dramatically drop.
Absolutely. I apologize. I had to hit the cough button. You know, here's a sign of the times, if you will. Over the last decade, we've had an abundance, a plethora of these title loan places pop up.
Mm-hmm.
And believe me, if I had the money, I would open one up because they make tons of money, and they make tons of money precisely because of the situation you just referred to. Somebody who is, you know, they're broke, they're living paycheck to paycheck or worse, and then all of a sudden they need $1,000 to fix a car, or an emergency, and they hawk their car. And let me tell you, interest is a beautiful thing, but not when it's working against you.
Exactly.
And when you're paying usurious rates that these title loan places are allowed to charge you, let me tell you, it is just such a terrible situation. Wesley, we're out of time, but I want to say thank you so much for stopping by. I appreciate your insights and a lot of great tips on paying off those student loans.
Hey, thanks, Bert. I really appreciate it. And, hey, have a good rest of the day. Enjoy your show.
All righty. Thank you so much. Good stuff there from Wesley Wood, president and CEO of Wood Financial Group, on how to get rid of those pesky student loans. The number one thing to take away from this is, A, start, do not pay off your student loan instead of creating a retirement account or an investment account. Start that before anything else. Your student loans are quite manageable. There's a lot of flexibility there. But yet, when it comes to retirement, believe it or not, time marches on much quicker than we think it does. We're going to take a quick commercial break, and then when we come back, we're going to talk about what to do should you ever get arrested right after this.
Welcome back to Geico Radio. It's savings on the radio.
Cooler Steve. Go right ahead.
Yeah, I just got a free rate quote on geico.com. Saved a ton, and it only took me 5 minutes and 12 seconds. I was wondering, is that some sort of record?
That's a good question. Then let's have a look.
Not quite. Someone's got you beat by 8 seconds.
Still, I mean, that's quite fast.
Well, what if I told you I only use one hand?
Geico. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch. And check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.
All right, we are back. You know, I'm a big believer that you have to prepare for any situation. My next guest, attorney Barry Bobbitt, he serves as managing partner for the Bobbitt Law Firm, where he concentrates his focus of practice in the areas of criminal defense. Barry is intensely committed to fighting for the rights and dignity of those who are victims of injustice at the hands of corporate and governmental interests. Barry Bobbitt, welcome to Money for Lunch.
Thanks, Bert. Glad to be here.
All right. So, you know, this is, I think, such an interesting thing because a lot of us think that, hey, when we're innocent, we have nothing to hide. And therefore, you know, I don't have to worry about ever being arrested because, you know, I'm a good person and I have nothing to hide. I'm not doing anything wrong out there. So, you know.
Yeah, it's such a dangerous mindset.
It is. Let me tell you, and you didn't know this, but I went in another life. I went to law school and I clerked and stuff like that. And so you don't realize what you don't know. And I think that everybody, this is one of the things that after going to law school, I realized that everybody should take that first year of law. That should be just mandatory because everybody's thinking would change, right?
I agree. It'd be great if everybody had kind of that background. The problem is that it starts to warp your mind and you come out and you can only look at things through a singular lens.
But that's good, though. That, to me, that's good because I think it would.
It's good for the attorney representing you. Sure, yeah, sure. It's good. It's great for the attorney that's representing you. That is good. We only have the capacity to look at things through one lens. You know what they say is that when you're a hammer, everything looks like a nail. So
right. Let's talk about this.
But you know, kind of going back to your original point, it is such a not only is it a dangerous mindset because you should be prepared for these things. Everyone should have a basic understanding of how our legal process works. But the problem is if you do find yourself in that situation or you've got someone in your family, it could be a son, daughter, wife, husband,
sure.
You know, cousin, whatever it is, they wind up in that situation. The system will use that night, you know, that against you. If you don't know, if you're not kind of equipped and have an idea, they'll act like your friend. They'll play, you know, like this is, you know, not much of an issue. And then before you know it, you've built a case against yourself.
Absolutely. In fact, that a whole hammer is a nail strategy you're talking about, when the cops are involved, everybody's guilty. That's what they're trying to do.
Yeah, you know, a common misconception is that the cops are an impartial party. That couldn't be further from the truth. They're paid by the same city government that is trying to prosecute you. They are in every sense of the word trying to build a case against you. They assume you're guilty. And so that's the assumption they start with.
That's not right.
You know, our justice system is built to presume innocent, but the cops are certainly starting their case presuming you're guilty.
Yeah, so they and I want to take it one step further. They presume you're guilty, and they also presume that you're lying.
Yeah, that's correct. Correct. You're not to be trusted.
Let's talk about this real quick.
And so, you know, that's the thing is that Well, if you get early in that process, at any whatever point in that legal process, you're not going to have an attorney. Ideally as soon as possible, everyone should know their right to request an attorney. But in that process, there's always going to be some part of that initial process when you're first arrested, when you're first gotten in trouble. It's just you and the officer, and yep. they will tell you, hey buddy, just work with me. And everything will be okay. And then if you're not going to work with them, then they go into like, well, look, you messed up really bad. Your life's going to be wrecked. It's all a lie. And until you get to sit in front of an attorney who can kind of explain to you the other side of it and the truth of it, the cops are just going to give you lies about this system.
So let's talk about this. Let's say, for whatever reason, I get arrested. What should I do after my arrest?
So the first and foremost thing you want to do is just stay calm and, collected. I know that's a difficult thing to say, but you just want to stay calm and collected. You're not going to help your matter by being belligerent with the officers. Cooperate with them as needed. If they don't have a warrant, they're trying to search something, then make sure they've got a warrant. You can just calmly ask if they have a warrant. If they try to circumvent that and they say, sometimes they don't have a warrant, they'll say, can I search your car? Can I search your house? And you're always entitled to say no. Now, they may choose to go ahead and do it anyways, but let your attorney deal with that afterwards and fight the legalities after that. As soon as possible, you want to keep your mouth shut, stay calm, collected, and request your attorney, because one of our constitutional rights is the police cannot continue to question you after you've asserted that right to an attorney. So that will shut them down. And if there's any further questioning or you say anything after that, it'll be excluded.
Now, and again, I want to point this out. Even if you're 100% innocent and you have nothing to hide, you should always assert your right for an attorney. This is
absolutely.
We cannot, I cannot say this enough, and I'm not an attorney by any means, but am I right?
Absolutely. I mean, absolutely, especially if you're innocent, because people are surprised at how misinterpreted evidence can be. You'll say something or do something completely in a sincere way or, in a completely innocent way, and then later on it gets turned against you, and you don't even know how you end up in that situation. How is that statement used against you? How is that fact or that disclosure used against you? Because they're in the job of taking everything you say and do to build a case against you. It's only your attorney's job, your defense attorney's job to bring, truth to the matter. So absolutely, they'll try to distort everything you say or do. So especially if you're innocent, you want to be quiet. And a lot of people think that's going to be held against them. That's not admissible from a jury that you've asserted your right to remain quiet and ask for an attorney. That can't be in front of a jury. And it's only going to, serve to protect you.
All right. So I want to throw this at you, because this is something that the police do, and it's portrayed on TV quite often, but they'll say, hey, well, if you're asking for an attorney, then I won't be able to help you. I mean, if you have nothing to hide, you don't need an attorney. So they're trying to persuade you not to assert your right. What do you say to that?
Yeah, I mean, that's police work 101. I'm your buddy. I'm your buddy. I'm trying to help you. And kind of what we've talked about, that just couldn't be further from that truth, that they're paid by the city to build a case against you. And it's just a lie. I mean, it's in the safe assumption. If you've been charged, if you've been accused of anything, if the police are not your friends, do not work with them. We even have a lot of people who come into us and say they're in the investigative phase. In other words, a charge hasn't been filed, but a detective will call them and say, hey, look, I just want to talk to you. And we're investigating your buddy, and we just want to talk to you. Or there's some, suspicious stuff. We don't think there'll be an issue. We just want to talk to you a little. You'd be surprised how many people will have that conversation with a detective as they just document everything they can to now bring a case against them. But the smart ones, we get a lot of these calls. They'll call and say, hey, look, nothing's been charged, but I got a detective that called me. Is this a point to bring in an attorney? And the answer is absolutely yes. If the officers are talking to you, it's always appropriate to bring in an attorney, because an attorney is going to mediate that situation. And you wouldn't believe how many times, picked up the phone, talked to the detective and said, hey, look, if you want any communication, you got to go through me. And all of a sudden, the phone calls stop. Nothing happens. No charges are pursued and nothing's followed up. But if the client had talked to that officer, you never know what's going to happen.
Yes. You know, and guys, this is I know for a lot of people it's hard to believe, but, you know, the reality is that we have this adversarial system, and it's there for a reason. Look, first of all, I want to say this. Police officers have a very difficult job. Very difficult job. They risk their lives. I mean, we've all seen and heard that police officers get killed for routine traffic stops. So by all means, you mentioned something a little bit earlier about not being belligerent. You should never be belligerent. They're doing their job. They're doing the best that they can with what they have. And it's not personal, or at least it shouldn't be personal. But bottom line is be respectful at all times. And just remain calm. And as Bert also said, assert your rights.
Yeah, Bert, I think that's a great point. This isn't a condemnation of officers. They're simply serving their role in the system, just as the prosecutors are. So this is their role in the system. So it's about having your eyes wide open and being knowledgeable about what their role is, and it's not to help you. So yeah, this, and I'm glad you clarified that. Certainly not a condemnation of officers. It's just smart for anyone to be aware of their role in the in that process.
Absolutely. So let's talk about this. Because this is, again, something that happens probably more often than just getting arrested for, you know, maybe out of the blue. But what happens when you get pulled over, somebody gets pulled over for a DWI or DUI. Let's talk about this, because I think, you know, this is probably, especially with younger people, this is a good chance of happening. So the first thing they're going to ask you is obviously to step out of the car, things of that nature. What should you do? Walk me through that. I mean, if I got pulled over I guess what I'm trying to say is what point do I have to cooperate? Yeah. I know I have to give up my license and my insurance. Yeah. And is that it?
That's pretty much it. That's pretty much it. And then saying I respectfully refuse to take the test. And, so you're right. This is a common scenario. The DWI scenario we're not out there assaulting and stealing from people. We don't really hang around, you know, not a lot of us hang around that crowd. But it's more than likely most of us know about a friend, an associate, a family, or themselves who have gotten pulled over for a DWI. Now it's a lie. Now let me tell you, it's a lie that if you've had a drink and you're driving, that it's against the law. The police want you to think that, but that's a lie. You have to actually be, have your mental faculties impaired. In Texas, right. It's a two-part test. You either have to have an alcohol level of 0.08, or you have to have your mental and physical faculties impaired to where you can't drive in a reasonable manner. So when the officers pulled you over, they've already made the assumption you've been drinking and driving. They are taking you to jail no matter what. So everything you do from that point is building a case. And a big misconception is that as if I just cooperate with the officer, then I get to go home and get in my cozy bed and have to, you know, this never happened.
Right.
Once you get pulled over, you are going to jail. So don't build evidence and a case against yourself. You're going to spend one night in jail. You'll get bonded out. From there on, you will spend no more time in jail unless you've had multiple offenses. Most people are talking about a first or even a second. You more than likely aren't going to spend time in jail if you have a defense attorney on the case. So just don't do anything to make this worse for you. In Texas, we have an automatic suspension of your license for 6 months. If you refuse to take field sobriety tests, they call it the implied consent law. Basically, when you get a driver's license, you just inherently agree to cooperate with an officer, but the only penalty is that you have your license withdrawn for 6 months. And even in Texas, it's very easy to get an occupational driver's license. So you can still go to work, you still go to the grocery store, you can still pick your kids up. You can really do all the normal duties you'd have to do anyways. So when they get out and the officers are very good at using the intimidation factor in their favor because it is intimidating. Late at night, got the lights going, they pull over, they're in their official uniform. Usually they travel in pairs. Both ask you to step out. They got the gun on their holster. Sir, we need you to start taking these tests. It's not even a request. They'll just tell you you have to do them. But your rights are to say, officer, I kindly refuse to do it. We've had many clients to do that. And when they don't build a case against them, it's much easier to go in the court and say, look, you really don't have any hard evidence against my client. You didn't do some field sobriety test. You know, you didn't do the breathalyzer. What evidence do you have? Because it's your job. It's your duty, or I'm sorry, your responsibility to prove to this jury beyond a reasonable doubt he actually committed the crime. You don't even have, you don't have any hard evidence of that.
Yeah, and again, this is something that does take a little bit of practice, and the reality is, again, if you're going to go out drinking, you should schedule, you know, you should schedule a driver in advance, either do a taxi or an Uber or get a designated driver. But in a case where you maybe you've only had one drink and you're not impaired, this is a perfect scenario here that Barry's talking about. It is just, you know, kindly and respectfully disagree, you know, what do you call it? Not disagree, but, you know,
decline.
Decline. Thank you. Decline to take the test, and you may be taken down. But as you said, it's not that big of a deal. It can't be scary.
It's worth overemphasizing, because I think a lot of people have heard this advice and they refuse to follow it. When they're in the actual situation, they get intimidated by the process. And before you know it, they start taking tests. And the officer says, hey, look, let's just do – you know what? You took those tests. You don't even seem drunk. Let's just do a breathalyzer, because I don't think you're going to blow over the limit, and we can just send you home. It's a lie. It's a lie. It's a lie. Do not forget, and, you know, tell your family members, do not forget, do not take these tests. I even go far as to say, if they take you to the jail and, you know, they videotape you, just sit on, and you can't stand straight, then sit on the ground and, you know, where you can sit, lay on the ground. Don't give them any evidence, because videotaping, you're swaying, that's going to be evidence against you. So just lay on the ground if you can't even stand or sit straight. But it is worth repeating. This is not, these are not trying to get out of the system. This is basically, when you've been arrested, it's my job to make sure that the prosecutors prove their case beyond a reasonable doubt. I agree with you completely. I'm one of the biggest proponents of driving safety. Do not put yourself in that situation only for the, not just for the legal consequences, more importantly, the safety aspects. If you hurt yourself or more significantly kill somebody else, that is something you'll never be able to shake. A DWI on your record too is not going to hurt you. Having someone's death or, you know, serious impairment on your conscience will you'll carry that with you for life.
Yes, and that's a really, really good point. I'm glad you said that. Let's talk about this. Let's talk about what is a warrant, and should I respond if all of a sudden I get a call and there's a warrant issued for my arrest? Talk about this.
Yeah, so warrants can be issued in two different ways. Sometimes they'll do it calmly and say, hey, look, we've got a warrant. They may even call you ahead of time and say, we're coming over, or we're going to your office, and we need to search some things. A lot of the times it's just they just kind of forego the knock and announce, so to speak. They just show up and they say, surprise, we're searching all your stuff. You're always entitled to ask to see if that's been signed by a judge. There are strict constitutional requirements, and I would say probably half of the case law in criminal is based on search and seizures and warrants. So there's a lot of parameters and a lot of nuances to this. You don't need to worry about that at that time. If they show up and they've got a paper warrant signed by a judge, let them do what they're going to do. And your attorney can fight the legalities of that later. If they don't have it, then and like I said, they ask you, then just politely decline. A lot of times they'll choose to do it anyways. They'll search you anyways. And, you know, so, but you don't resist them. Just go along and let your attorney handle that issue later. Now, if the officers actually see the commission of a crime, and they have a reasonable suspicion that something's occurring, they can do a warrantless search. But again, like I said, don't debate the officer on that. You're not going to win that. Just cooperate and let your attorney deal with that later.
Yeah, And I want to emphasize what you said earlier. Look, it's not we're not talking about some kind of tactics to get out of the system to circumvent the law. It's really, again, what we had said, what I had said earlier about being an adversarial system. These guys have a certain point of view that they're trying to fulfill their duties, and you have a right to fulfill your duties, to assert your rights, to protect yourself. There is nothing wrong ever by asserting your rights. There's nothing wrong.
Absolutely.
You can assert your rights and still be a decent person and be, a, you said, professional or polite and respectful. There's nothing wrong with saying, hey, I respectfully decline. I'd like to talk to my attorney. These officers have a difficult duty and their training is to see everything through those glasses.
Yeah, and this even and where I see that come up a lot is when clients are when they're doing the initial arraignment, they've got to enter a plea of guilty or not guilty. I've had clients say, "Well, I'm going to enter guilty," and first of all, I say, "Well, look, you don't even know what the elements of this offense are. It means you're not even really technically you're not even qualified to determine whether you committed offense. You're just going off what the officers told you. So let's figure out whether you actually did it." But second, this is not a morality issue. If you go in and you say, not guilty, I want to assert my right to a jury trial, that's not a morality issue. That is a constitutional right in which that makes our process work. You fight it. You say, look, we're going to make the prosecutor prove our case beyond a reasonable doubt. They put the evidence. And if you did it, you know, the jury's going to make that ultimate decision. But you always have the right to say, not guilty. I want to make the prosecution prove that I did it. It's not a morality thing. It's a constitutional right.
Yes.
And a judge will never hold that against you. Never. Because they recognize that right.
Well, absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, bottom line is, look, there is also, I'll say, you know, degrees of guilty. I mean, there is, what do you call it? By waiting, my point, what I'm trying to say here, by pleading not guilty, it makes the prosecution show you the evidence, and then you can look at it with your attorney and say, you know what, I'm willing to agree to this, but not to this other stuff, and then you can see what that really means.
Yeah. Ideally, you want to have full disclosure of what the evidence actually shows, and most states have some type of laws that require the prosecution to disclose any evidence that would help in your favor. So, it's up to debate whether that's actually followed through, but that's the law in most states. But and so you get a real clear understanding of what you've been charged with, what the evidence is against that, what you should be playing to, what you should be fighting. So even saying not guilty and saying I want to pursue this means let's get a more clear understanding of what I've actually been charged with and what evidence you have that I did that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because I went to law school and I worked for a law firm and I clerked and all that stuff. I personally, not that I get too many of them, but occasionally I will get a speeding ticket or a traffic citation. And I do enjoy fighting them. And I want to say that I win 90% of them or 80% of them I win. And then the other 20%, I do some kind of probation so it doesn't hit my points my record. My point being, though, there was a scenario a while back where I had showed up because I had gotten a parking ticket and I was fighting that. And the police officer that showed up, basically he was the witness against me. He was there and he witnessed that his statement was that he saw that the meter had expired and therefore wrote me a ticket. And the judge, because he's a police officer, he's given a little bit more, what's the word I'm looking for?
Leeway.
Credibility. Sure. And so the judge says, okay, sure. He kind of proved his prima facie case that I had violated the parking statute or whatever. As we started, so I said, well, let's the judge said, hey, do you want to just accept a guilty plea and we can just move on? And I said, no, we're here for trial. Let's do this trial thing. And so we went to trial, and the police officer opens up his folder, and he's got a completely different vehicle in there.
Yeah, that's a common. You'd be surprised at how many times we see that.
I got that case dismissed and I got lucky. But my point being is, just because, back to what you were saying, just because the government says you did something wrong, and I'm just using that as a minor example, you know, doesn't mean that you, quote, really did anything wrong. And B, it doesn't mean that they have all the facts.
Yeah, they work on misinformation and misinterpreting the facts. They overstate it. That's just part of what they do. That's why it's so important to go see to get a criminal defense attorney involved as soon as possible. One of the biggest benefits of seeing a criminal defense attorney is that you have all these fears of the unknown, what's going to happen. And you start thinking about worst case scenarios, and you have the officers telling you, you're the worst kind of criminal. And so when you're able to sit in front of an attorney and they say, look, I've handled this issue. And in fact, I've actually been in front of this judge and I've had the same kind of case. Let me tell you more than likely what's going to happen. You're not going to do time. This is probably not going to affect your job, depending on what kind of job you have. It's going to cost you this much rather than this, you know, this much. And just that alleviating the fears is one of the biggest benefits, because your mind can just start playing tricks on you and you assume the worst. So that's a huge benefit. You know, in your scenario, I it sounded like you were going in front of a judge. I've been doing this long enough to be very skeptical about judges. I always trust a jury. The jury, it's amazing on seeing so many jury trials, how serious they take their job. They really want to get to the truth. And then the voir dire process, when you're kind of vetting the potential jurors to be on your panel, it's a common question to say, hey, look, does that officer have more credibility in your eyes just because he's an officer and he's got a uniform? Mm. And it's interesting, because in some jurisdictions, I've stopped asking that question because they're more biased against officers. And you see the prosecutors asking the question more, because in some jurisdictions, there's more of a bias against the officers. Now, some of them, you've got to pursue that, because they really do help hold the officers in esteem, as they should. But the point is that before they've heard any evidence, are they giving that witness, that officer, more credibility than he's due just because of his position? And that's where it's dangerous. And that's kind of what you ran into, that scenario, is that officer said, yeah, absolutely, I'm ready to go, and I know what the facts are. And then when you get him on the stand, it turns out he's completely confused about what case it was.
Yeah. Let me ask you this. Let's talk about this real quick. I want to get your thoughts. I'm going to put you on the spot a little bit. If I had to hire a defense attorney, what should I be looking for?
You first want to know how many cases he's handled of a similar nature, and you want the outcomes. A good experienced attorney is not going to shy away from those questions. You also want to have a confidence and a rapport. Now, that's a tricky line to kind of, you know, weigh, because you go in and you want the attorney to be comfortable in the matter he's speaking with, but you don't want him to be arrogant. You want him to be able to talk to you on your level, empathize with you, kind of see where you are uniquely, because not every case is the same. So you want an attorney to see that. Also, if he can connect with you, more likely he can connect with the jury. If you get some guy who's real arrogant and talks down to you, what do you think he's going to do when he gets in front of a jury? They're going to sense that right away. So always be straightforward about fees. You don't want anything to be hidden. Good attorneys, they're going to tell you up front what it's going to cost you until you get to the trial, and they can usually just give you an estimate. A good attorney is going to be expensive, and he's not going to be apologetic about that. It's going to say, hey, look, here's my fee. And there's a reason why I charge that amount, because it's taken a lot of years and a lot of experience to do what I do. And, I kind of know the right nuts to tweak. I mean, the right bolts to tweak and right, you know, nails to hit to get this resolved favorably. Also make sure there's a clear line of communication. Who do you talk to?
what's your expectations of getting a response? You know, because like I said, when you're going through a criminal charge, there's a lot of anxiety that's built up, and information is the best antidote to that. Having clear information can alleviate those fears.
I love it. I love it, Bobby. It's been an absolute pleasure having you on the show. I hope people will, if anything, take away the fact that no matter what, they need to ask for an attorney. They need to assert their rights. Barry Bobbitt, thank you so much for stopping by.
All right. Thanks, Bert. It's been fun.
Yeah. Good stuff there from Barry Bobbitt on how to